This is Daryl War, and you're listening to the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows podcast. This will be a retrospective for episode 15, A Blundering Succubus, in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows audio play, which is a multi-fandom relief series for the 1960s television program Dark Shadows that invites many different spooky show and movie characters to pitch in and help the besotted Colin Wood residents and characters. I'd love to be releasing more episodes of the audio drama to you, but human mortals being what we are, there has been no real way in this early 21st century time period to collect the needed morale and rush this production. Because as you likely realize, I've tried to rush this thing for about 5 years and it doesn't work. Minus with the pen pals who are interested, but I got their commentary, like I said, just 6 months when I finally found him again. Oh, you guys are gorgeous. But that is for the pit, and that's what this is about. It is going to be a retrospective about episode 15, which I decided, yeah, let's just get back to the fun. And hopefully everybody who's getting all paranoid can maybe just reflect what I was going through for this last half decade of just all the paranoia. Like, oh, this is communication technology for a reason. We're supposed to be communicating. Everybody's getting all spy weird and gossipy. And I'm like, oh, you know, time to move on. Really, it is. And I am right there. So I hope everybody is pleased with this turn of events so I can present you with something so we can continue to just enjoy life. Let us get to A Blundering Succubus and going through the retrospective of that. I had done another one about 6 months to a year ago, and I'm still unhappy with it, so I think I'm just, okay, I'm going to throw it away and start over, because I was looking through things, I wanted to talk about Heather O'Rourke, and then I was finding this gossip, and it just put me in a foul mood. Foul. So, that particular recording didn't work out as well as I would like to have. So, with 15, where I was at, I had finally hit my stride, which of course was broken by the onslaught of what social media was doing to people that I didn't know about yet. But I had hit my stride because I'd come up with 14, and I had 15 almost ready, and I'd also gotten in touch with John Mountain to try and get the podcast better advertised to find the right people. And that's what all this is about, is finding the right people. I'm sorry that a lot of the wrong people found out about it. You know, people without the interest, or that they're threatened or something by one of the romances, or all the romances, or whatever they're threatened by, but, you know, you can turn it off. That is your prerogative to be able to do that. So I had opened it with Milligan and Hecubus, of course, but re-listening to it, I noticed that the very first thing is the dedication to Heather O'Rourke, and that was one of the things that disturbed me before I understood what was going on, is that, well, somebody give it up for the girl. You know, say something. And I just felt like, okay, everybody's just become heartless. But that being said, one of the reasons I did that is there were elements of, you know, Sarah's ghost is back. There's a little girl involved. There's a little poltergeist derivative soundtrack music, which I was so elated to even find. I did not know there were lyrics to that song for the poltergeist theme. And they're wonderful. But also, Heather O'Rourke was very close to my age. I think there was a year difference, maybe half a year. So I felt, yeah, here I am from her age bracket. Everybody was very upset when she passed away. And I thought, yeah, this episode should be dedicated to her for the sake that she also wanted to pursue her career in entertainment and possibly even behind the camera rather than in front of it. You know, and you never know, because a lot of times when child stars hit puberty and a little bit after that, it all just becomes about gearing them towards more sexual moneymakers. But that has improved, I believe, in the last couple of decades. So I am happy that that's happened. And we just won't know because she did pass away. Now, Milligan is also very happy that Angelique is a vampire because he says she's hotter still that way. And that's how I felt. I felt she looked a lot better as a vampire than a witch. Or Cassandra. And Milligan is also hoping to entice Angelique with his dark silvery jacket, which, yes, is in the Pit of Ultimate Darkness. And I noticed that Barnabas looked like he had a very similar one. So Milligan says that even though Hecubus is claiming the babes don't flock to his dark silvery jacket, that Angelique certainly should, because where do you think I got it from? meaning Barnabas Collins, if I got anything from him but a game of cards, it's this. So I thought it was very, very appropriate of the possibility that Barnabas Collins could have given a smoking jacket of some kind to Sir Simon Milligan, and that's why he's wearing it. It took me a while to notice, but I was like, you know, it could be the same coat if you look at it the right way. And so with the next scene, Blair is asking Vampire Angelique to sort of hypnotize Barnabas somehow to bring him to them, and she tries using the same kind of spell work that Milligan and Hecubus use, and Hecubus is concerned that she's also ripping them off, but Milligan is expressing, oh, she's allowed to. Blair's not allowed to. She is, though. But I don't think it's going to work. And then, of course, it leads to, well, the only thing that it really did was have a fly buzzing around Barnabas so that he whaps away. And that's the Collinsport fly that a lot of people make jokes about. And because the spell is not working to hypnotize Barnabas to bring him over, Angelique and Blair believe that it's going to work. So they figure, well, while we wait, we'll play Gin Rummy. And so they're going through all these games of Gin Rummy, and Angelique is whipping his butt. I just thought there's got to be some little thing that I can give her to sort of win something. But boy, he is. I mean, that's the thing. That's why I say Nicholas Blair's the wicked stepchild of my adopted brood, is that he just keeps losing. Like, everything. Because there's too much weirdness going on that he just can't do his job right. And one of my pen pals, who did run home from school, she was very satisfied with Nicholas Blair asking, what did I do to deserve this? And her response was, everything wrong. But there is that little nodule of Angelique kind of remembering somebody was trying to tell her something important. And that is sort of this glimmering of this old memory that before she died, before becoming a vampire, that it was the ghost of Jeremiah, but she's just kind of can't remember right now. But that's just sort of slowly moving her in the right direction of the right people talking to her, influencing her to progress into a better person who doesn't have all of these inner struggles, trying to control people and mess with them and all that, you know, just try to teach you what being a nice person is and how it works. And during the game, Angelique starts bitching about the coffin. And she's saying it's ridiculous, and Blair's perturbed, like, well, I went through all this trouble for this, that, and the other thing. She's like, well, what's up with the cutlass? Who do you think I am, Anne Bonny or Mary Read? And now I remember getting O'Sheen. She thought, oh, wow, I would love to see Angelique as a pirate. But, of course, where the cutlass is actually coming from is one of the designs for the Shriners. That was a mistake from the Undertaker's office. Just assuming, oh, they must be part of the Shriners parade, so let's put the logo on there, and they hadn't finished it, so ultimately, this scene with them playing Gin Rummy, when I came up with it and I was reading it to my husband back in 2013, it was harsh, because we were laughing so hard, we were falling down, we were wetting ourselves pretty much, I mean, maybe just a little bit, but, you know, I don't want to exaggerate that, but, I mean, it was difficult, because just the idea, and all the stuff that they're saying. Yeah, it was rough when I read this to him, the Gin Rummy game. So Blair is suggesting, well, why don't you just walk over there and get to him? And she's worried, well, maybe then he'll just give out that line about us being two boats passing in the night. Because that must have come out of him at some point in the past. And then, of course, one of the favorite lines of, I believe, a lot of people is Blair saying, start your walk, and if he's on his way, you can cut him off at the pass, you dimwit. And she says, I'd rather cut him off at the pants. That's like, I'd rather cut him off at the pants. Just me playing with the puns. But yeah, it just seemed like she would, that would be her preference. Blair is just like, well, you make no jest about that. However, at least the noise has stopped and the manager is leaving us alone. So like the demonic brooding that used to just encompass room 13 of the Collinsport Inn that they're... So, yeah. Up to it, and then of course, you know, she's probably wandering through all this either set or just sticky stuff, weeds and whatnot, bits of nature, and getting burrs and foxtail seeds in her dress. Sorry. Well, it's supposed to be fun, isn't it? So, I'm just giving her a lot. Like, I wish I had a broom to ride, even though I don't think that as a witch she would have ridden a broom, but it's just something that she's saying. And then thinking, oh, wait, well, if I'm a vampire, can't I just fly there and hear a fooming noise? And she just doesn't have the energy. She hasn't had a taste of anybody's blood yet. So she's like, well, I got to fix that problem before I go in to get Barnabas. And then she's thinking, and she sees the Great House. Roger's always been good for a drink. I forgot how funny this darn one was. Because, yeah, Roger has been good for a drink. So, again, the double meaning is she's wanting blood and he's good for a drink, usually the alcoholic kind. And so then, yeah, Roger opens the door and really is like, huh? You know, and he recognizes her. But he thinks, oh, Cassandra decided to be blonde and spent a very long time at a beauty parlor in Boston. And he's already got his annulment, but he's as sarcastic as they come. You know, not even a postcard. Didn't even send me a postcard. He just disappeared. And since she's been on the other side, you know, been dead and come back, well, from where I've been, I wasn't sure where to find one. So he shows off the annulment. He was happy there. But then she's also able to hypnotize him a little bit. And that was a good thing because I wasn't even sure what was going to happen when I was putting this together. I thought, oh, this is a great time for Lily Munster to just come down the stairs like, oh, hey, there's another vampire in it. You know, I can sense it. And, oh, I want to see them. And because that's what she is. That's why she's Lily Munster nee Dracula, like her dad is Sam Dracula. But then she sees, oh, no, you're doing the naughty thing where you're taking advantage of somebody and you don't do it that way as far as I'm concerned. That also goes in good with when you see the opening of the Munsters and Grandpa tries to take a bite out of her and she's like, hey. And she's like, no, Dad, no, do that. And yes, I am taking some liberties with Lily Munster because I figure it's after the Munsters finished. And so she's probably grown a little bit in certain directions, certain things that we didn't see on the Munsters. So she has that ability to be a bit more vampiric and be able to notice that, well, this new vampire that I don't know doesn't seem to be quite like me. But I'm sure there's a little something that I can do to dissuade her from making any trouble here because this is family. I don't want that problem. And thankfully, Roger's hypnotized. He's off in space. His head's in the clouds. So he's not even noticing half of what's going on. And Lily just takes care of the situation, turns vampire Angelique into a bat, and closes the door and wishes her a good night. But at that point, Roger snaps too and asks what happened. And she thought, oh, well, you know, that if you went into a daze, that happens to the best of us. And just sort of flounces back up the stairs after a short explanation where Roger's like, you know, Mother really should have told us more about her side of the family. But then, she did always say it was complicated. And if it's more complicated than our lives have been, I don't blame her for not trying to explain it. And that I did try to double-check years later with O'Sheen. What do we know about Roger and Elizabeth's mother? Do we know that much? You know, it could possibly go anywhere if we don't know that much. So I figured that that's where Lily being a cousin comes from, is their mother's side of the family, the non-Collins name. And so with the next scene, it is another Adams family scene because I wanted to keep them in. Hopefully I did them enough justice because I'm also going with this is a few years after their show ended, so they could have gone into slightly different directions. And so again with Grandmama, a witch who doesn't like the word, but she's producing a kind of spell where Victoria can project her memories and they can all see them just on the vapor from the cauldron. However she's putting it together. And to practice, she's asked to come up with something strong, an experience of a time when she was most scared for her life. And I figure where Trask was getting down on her in the 1790s, that was probably the one that she would eventually think of. And of course, Grandmama and Morticia are just like, whoa, looking at this Trask guy. And Grandma, just what a widow's peak he had. Because he really did. I mean, we saw, me and my husband were like, he could have been the vampire with that widow's peak. He looks like he's the one who should be. And especially because you know that Joey Lacey, I mean, that was makeup very clearly. It wasn't just hair. It was, you could see the actual makeup. It made the point. Poor guy. I had to wear that. And this was another thing where I was hoping that there must be more than us watching this and seeing him put the VW on the ground. And we're thinking, because we see that logo for VW Volkswagen. And Lisa, yes, she was like, yeah, every time I see that. And I had not grown up with Lisa in my life. But then you see, like, yeah, every time I watch that one, I instinctively think Volkswagen. And so with that, you know, our experiences, before I even knew who Lisa was, Grandmama has this same idea where if he's from the 18th century, he's got a preoccupation for Volkswagens.
And if he was able to see into the future to know what a Volkswagen is, he ought not to have behaved so cruelly to Victoria Winters. So she's just confused. And it's like, no, that's just my initials, Mrs. Adams. It's not anything. And I think at some point it was Mrs. Frump, because I was going with a different incarnation, what I knew of the Adams. So I remember when I studied, I was like, okay, it's Gomez's mother, not Morticia's mother. So when Grandmama understands what's going on with this memory, it's like, okay, so you're remembering a time that's like way before your birth, and we're not looking for one that is that far back, but this is practice. And so the purpose of this scene is to try and find a way that Victoria Winters could use her powers, because in the beginning of the scene, Milligan explains that it's possible that Reverend Trask was accidentally correct, and Victoria Winters really is a witch, and he just didn't know, because he'll suspect everyone, because that's what people did back then. And so that I figured that if she could time travel, then maybe she's got some magical powers. And that's good, too. And so they're working that out. That is another thing. I have seen Alexandra Moltke's interview where she's responding to a question. We don't know what it is because they always edit those things out. It bothers me because it's like we want to know the context of what they're responding to. But she's like, you know, I wish I could have been something like a vampire or a witch. And I hear that and I think, I got you covered, even though she doesn't get to have the acting experience for it. But in the case of maybe this is something that the actress would have been groovy with, to have been a witch as Victoria Winters. So it pulls together that way. And so then she's just learning things. And as a lot of fictional witchcraft goes, usually if you're over 13, you can't really be as powerful without the practice. But, well, you know, I figured, well there's just going to be a little bit then. It could be a big bit eventually. And then Morticia repeats what we heard in episode 13 about a lot of problems tend to start with people in authority taking advantage. And I think all of us know that that is true. And Victoria says, well, now I see why you keep to the house most of the time. And I felt it was a very, very Adams thing for Morticia to admit, precisely, create your own little sanctuary and enjoy it to the full. So I was learning, yeah, that's how the Adams family operate. They like their home, and they have a lot of space in that home. They do go out once in a while, but it's their haven, their sanctuary. That's a lot of what the Adams family is about. Moving on to the sixth and seventh scene, which do blend together quite a bit, because Maggie and Barnabas are looking from Josette's room. And I've noticed when I work with Maggie reincarnated, the calmest she actually gets is in Josette's room. That's when she seems to be the closest to her old lives. So what they're witnessing, they're going through a kind of reacquaintance in a very strange way, but they're also watching Willie and Sarah from the window. And initially I had it as a hide-and-seek game, but I realized that that's too awkward. So it just became more of a conversation that they're spending time together. And Barnabas and Maggie can observe them from far away and wonder at what they're up to, what they might be talking about. And so then we cut to that, and that's also where there's a music box version of the Poltergeist theme, Bless This House. And Maggie also mentions that, you know, maybe they need their own music box. So that was how that got into there. And Willie is just enchanted with the ghost of Sarah. It's getting him back in touch with more of a childlike aspect that maybe he would have missed out on a bit in his youth. That still remains a mystery. His youth in general, I believe, is more of a mystery. And because Sarah Collins, her ghost, is often so vague about what she knows and what she doesn't know, I figure that's part of just being a ghost, that things will come to her at kind of random moments. And so Willie asks if she dreams, if she has the opportunity, and she says, of course I do, and talks about what she dreams about, and that when she dreams, he seems to have all the answers, but when she wakes up, she loses them. So the idea of a ghost sleeping is strange, but it factors into this scene. And then, of course, since David, I felt, needed a friend earlier on than Amy, he's out looking, and he notices, oh, Willie Loomis is back! Whoa! David hasn't noticed that yet. So Willie addresses David, and, bet you never expected to see me again, huh? And that they're sitting on a pile of leaves, like he's surprised to see with Sarah on a pile of leaves. It's like, this is just strange. Everybody's just dealing with the fact that we've got ghosts, and now everybody can see Sarah. How weird is this? At least that I feel that's what's going through David Colton's mind. And in this also, Willie gives Sarah credit that she's making more good come out of everybody. But Willie is going to go hang out with Wadsworth to see what his new duties might entail. But Sarah wonders why Willie is going to leave. Like, why doesn't he stay? And this was something I also just learned personally, that sometimes when you want to be with a friend, sometimes you just want to be with that friend and not share that friend with anybody, just to have that time with that particular friend. And that often happens too when we start to couple ourselves, having boyfriends and girlfriends and that kind of thing, romantic liaisons, even in an innocent way. And then when that happens, a lot of times we start to feel that, oh, well, now my friendship's in jeopardy because this other person is always around that friend of mine. So I figured Willie could also understand that maybe David and Sarah, being little kids, even though Sarah's a ghost, that it's important to spend time alone with another friend. And he wants to give David that opportunity. But what's fun is that David asks, "You've met the new butler?" And you don't know the half of it, Willie says. Not the half. We actually go way back. And when Willie leaves, David's kind of dumbstruck, trying to articulate what he perceives as a change in Willie. And Sarah says it, he's calmer now. And David wonders how that happens. And Sarah says, people love him now. And I think they always did, really. And David figures that Jason McGuire really hurt him a lot, more than rest of the grown-ups, maybe. Just understanding Willie in that way as being more childlike as opposed to childish. And then, oh, I asked to do a little studying of hopscotch to see if both Sarah and David could play it. And then we go back, as Hecuba says, in Josette's aquamarine room of many ornate fixtures. I'm not sure if it's actually aquamarine. I just figured, well, light blue, let's just throw that in there. And then Maggie is happy with what she's at least seen, what she's gathered about what was going on through the window. And she's looking through the old trunk that I made up. I figured it would be there. Josette's coming to Collinwood to stay indefinitely. And going through old books to see if it would be useful for David's studies. And Barnabas gets a little curious. Who was Kitty Soames? Because he doesn't know yet. Maggie knows. And she's like, well, if you don't know, then you're just going to have to find out. Just gonna have to find out on your own, because if I tell you too much, then that could mess with what we're trying to achieve here. She says, you'll have to trust that you'll come back to this Josette, meaning me, Maggie Evans, standing here afterward, after you go through that. So it's setting up eventually that the 1897 journey will happen for Barnabas. And then Wadsworth enters, and he has long standing had this interesting nickname for Maggie. He calls her Madam, then pauses, and then says Mazelle, because he would call her Mademoiselle, whereas he often calls all these other people Madam, but for her, there's a pause and the Mazelle, meaning, I know that you're Josette Dupré, so I'm adding a little bit more French. And also wondering if she has a preference of what she would like to be called overall, and having to figure out, among all these various names, how difficult that could be. She agrees. But the reason that Wadsworth is there to announce that there is a gathering of the clan that they're invited to. And Maggie wonders, as a potential fiancé or governess, am I invited? And Barnabas is kind of a very weird line for him, but he pauses between it. He just decides, yeah, I'm going to say it, that if she isn't invited, I'll spit. And Wadsworth is shocked. After everything else, this is that one thing. You know, I'd hate to believe you changed so much to expectorate on your home, sir. And so with the next scene, this was big highlight, because Elizabeth Stoddard, she's trying to explain that she's going to go away on a trip, but instead she wants to get everybody's attention. And I just thought, wouldn't it be the funniest thing? I've never seen this in fan work. I've never seen this in any version of Dark Shadows, but wouldn't it be just hilarious? Because we care so much about the Collinwood estate, like seriously care about it. It is, for some of us, it's like our home on the TV screen. So I thought it just really shocked both the audience as well as the family, that she's saying, well, I've actually come to a decision, and it's a very big decision, and after all this time, I have decided that I'm going to sell Collinwood. And then everybody's just cups clattering and all these various exclamations, everybody's shocked. And one of the listeners, she was like, oh my God, WTF, I just about had a heart attack. And then, of course, Barnabas steps in, just cool as a cucumber, well, how much? You know, if you're going to sell it, I'll buy. You'll find some way to gather the cash. And the pen pal said, Barnabas wanting both houses? Why? Because he's a Collins. She says, she kind of asks the question and then answers it. And Lisa also enjoyed it. She's like, I'm going to sell Collinwood. Everyone is crazy and all freaking out, except Barnabas, who asks deadpan how much. He's so disappointed when Elizabeth reveals it was just a ploy to get everyone's attention. Damn, still deadpan. Loved it. And, yeah. Forgot it. I'm just like, why the hell would you want both houses? You already got the old house. Why do you want this one, too? Just a pipe dream, Roger. He scoffs. I'd rather doubt that. And it's great, too, because Carolyn was like, oh, that was a good one, Mother, because, yeah, we did get our attention. And there is that old endearment of Roger calling Carolyn kitten, that she's developing a broader sense of humor that calls her kitten. And I figured it'd be great to have Carolyn's response be, meow, Uncle Roger. Oh, and then it was great just because there was a little quotation. And before it's revealed who the quote was, Lisa was the one who said, I initially thought, yeah, that's Judith Collins. There was something in there. I try to pretend that we're nicer than we actually are, and that something always comes up that makes me face the truth. And Lisa was able to get that because she's a huge fan of this show. Really understands of the Dark Shadow show, as opposed to all the other ones and this particular one that I'm making. And it comes back to the Dale Carnegie book. There's a mention of the Dale Carnegie book that Barnabas managed to get Roger to start reading without him really knowing that he was trying to get him to do that. Just that it was weird for Barnabas to have all the skeletons out of the closet and everybody's talking about them, and that it's all casual. And Roger said, well, have you ever read How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, Cousin Barnabas? Not entirely, but I see that you have. Well, I forget just how chock full of goodies episode 15 really is. And then there's a discussion in the foyer where Elizabeth's trying to get Barnabas to go in and see Cousin Lily. And so one of my big highlights is this actual meeting, because it's Lily Munster. And I didn't realize this till way later, that Jonathan Frid is playing the vampire Barnabas Collins. Comes from Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada. Lily Munster, played by Yvonne DiCarlo, comes from British Columbia. So they're both Canadians playing TV vampires. Oh my gosh. So there's that element, and I wish that I'd done this better, but, you know, I'm not going to beat myself up over it. Because, I mean, the lines are really where it goes. Where Maggie's hanging out with Lily in this other portion of the house, and Barnabas enters, and there's some coffee in there. And they're family, so Lily says there's no need to worry about the formalities. And she just very casually, again, he's getting just blown away by all the casualness of all the spooks and the crazies and all these things that other people might see as ghastly. And that was, just as a brief aside, that's one of the reasons that I couldn't find a way that the Addams family and the Collins family would be related. They're both big. Maybe there's some marriage floating around out there or something that we wouldn't know. But the difficulty I had is that the Addams family embraced their strangeness, and the Collins family just seemed scared to death of it, of their strangeness. It just seemed so wanting to cover stuff up and all of these things. So that's why I couldn't get that. But Lily off to the side is, you know, off Liz and Roger's mother, Jameson's wife, is possibly a monster over there. That seemed to be something that I could do. And so Lily, when everybody's comfortable, asks very casually, Barnabas, are you a vampire? And they're all, Barnabas and Maggie are just shocked. Like, did she just say so casually? And because of the pseudo ex-vampire thing, where he's cured, kind of not, kind of danced around this stuff, giving him all these different things to possibly be, we'd never find out if the Adam thing really worked or why the heck it did, if it worked. I mean, it just so vague. And so all I could think of that Barnabas would answer is, as to the question of being a vampire, well, not so much anymore, because he's not even sure. Because he, through the show, even when it seems like he's cured, he's sometimes worried that, oh, I'm going to revert. Oh, no, da-da-da-da-da. And so all you could say is, well, not so much anymore. You know, I'm not even sure myself. And wondering how Lily can be so cheerful about the subject. And so that's when she mentions, okay, there's this other vampire floating around. And she also doesn't seem to be like me, Lily is explaining, that there are many different kinds of us, meaning different kinds of vampires, just like there's all different sorts of different mortals. And didn't my father ever tell you that? And then she's like, oh, wait, I don't think he ever really meant. I heard you were a bit tied up somewhere for a while. And so she's making the offer of, if you ever want to be one again, like a vampire, with more conveniences, because she can go around in the day, and that's another thing Barnabas is totally confused by. So she makes the offer. Feel free to ask me. And he's doubting it. But that is, you know, I was looking. I thought people would think, oh, that's too cheesy for Margaret Zed to pray that this is all coming from Lily Munster. But nobody, I mean, like I say, everything's changed. Everybody's like, I swear, so much of life seems to have become a soap opera now. I mean, it was kind of that way before with the news and everything, but us all becoming each other's crazy tabloid news with the social media. It's like, okay, now the whole world is a soap opera at this point. But in a world before all that happened, I was thinking that somebody was going to complain, you know, if they had their head screwed on straight and they had some issues, that Lily Munster giving Barnabas and Maggie the gift of a daylight walking vampirism would be cheesy. But I've never gotten that complaint. Never, never, never. Maybe somebody said it and I didn't hear, but so, you know, I was asking, looking, does anybody have something that's less cheesy? Okay, fine. We'll do it this way. And so that I'm giving Lily Munster the credit. And I know a lot of people have these issues with Twilight being daylight walking vampires who sparkle. And I'm going back to the 60s and saying, hey, we got daylight walking vampires over here and they can see themselves in mirrors. So there you go. I mean, I know it's cheesy, or it used to be cheesy. Maybe it isn't anymore. I've missed something, but yeah, that's where it goes. And she also mentions Uncle Caleb. So there's just so much chock full going on. And it's very condensed, like I was trying to do. That's another thing that Lily is, she herself is critiquing the famous portrait of Barnabas Collins. And she's like, I think you should have lowered your head a bit for that. That would have brought out your eyes more and your chin less. And then, oh, well, there's another one. And it's like, well, if it's not with the coat, then I don't want to see it. And then Maggie's like, well, maybe we just do another one, you know, with the coat. Wouldn't that be great? And then Barnabas decides that, okay, I'm going to have to find this Uncle Caleb that Lily Munster's talking about. Moving on to the 10th scene, which is a really good, strong one for Willie and Wadsworth. And I am really uncertain how many fans would like to see Willie Loomis calm down and get settled with himself, but this is a very good example of him doing that. It is basically seeing to the kitchen at the old house, not quite sure exactly where that would be. But Wadsworth is renowned. He likes to keep the kitchen tidy. And Willie, having known him in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, that they're being reacquainted. So he notices that, yeah, this is what I would expect from you, having everything so tidy. And outside of the real strength of this scene are these little implements, like mentioning Mrs. Ho, who was in Clue the movie. But of course, when she's mentioned, Wadsworth feels bad. It's like, well, she didn't survive, so if only she had a better butler. So then he moves on to stacking the pans for baking on the bottom shelf and the ones for the range on the top and bottom, should be easier to remember. And I wonder if that's helped anyone, because it's been annoying in my past to try to figure out how to arrange things in the kitchen. So I realized later, yeah, it would make a lot more sense that if you have two shelves, you put stuff for the range, which is usually higher up, on the top shelf, and then stuff that goes in the oven, which is usually lower down, on the bottom shelf. But Willie starts to really reflect on things, and Wadsworth is a good person to go to for him to understand what he's, you know, to have somebody to talk about it with, and sort out what he's experiencing in people finally being nice to him. So initially, when I had started this as a farce, I thought, well, wouldn't it be funny by episode 13, everybody's being nice to him and he can't figure out why, so that makes him even crazier. But we're going with more humor mystery serial and less farce. Wadsworth is wondering what surprised Willie in his experience with Professor Stokes beginning to teach him how to use calligraphy, how to use tools for better penmanship, because that was something by episode 5 Professor Stokes had figured out. If you want this person to improve, suggest something little. Let's go with something that seems very small, but will eventually help his confidence level as well. And part of that was just because he was so plagued with seeing this postcard from Willie Loomis that had such horrible handwriting. And I just didn't realize that Stokes had kind of taken me over in understanding, well, yeah, I'm a professor, and you look over these papers, and you want to be able to actually read them. And noticing the benefits that good penmanship brings out. Because even now, I get people saying, well, penmanship's so horrible. And I'm like, well, I read what you wrote, so I can tell that you're complaining about it. It was legible enough for me to understand. And people get very down on themselves for that. Though I guess not doctors, because I got enough to worry about. But the thing, and some of this does come from personal experience, Willie's explaining that Professor Stokes wasn't doing things in a way where it was like, I'm giving you a chance to improve yourself. You must take this challenge. It was just putting the pen in his hand, and of course you can. That was something that's helped me a great deal in my life, because there's always this pressure to do something right. It's an interesting thing that I learned that very often, that's not what gives people confidence. What can also give people confidence is being casual about it. And that's what Willie learned from Professor Stokes, that he didn't really feel, oh, I can do this penmanship thing. But Professor Stokes felt, well, of course you can. And he just put the materials in front of him. And Willie has this moment of reflection that stuns him. Because for the most part, a lot of people have treated Willie Loomis badly. And so then bad comes out. Sound familiar? When you're giving me bad and bad comes out of Daryl? So it's wonderful. And hopefully people understand that. But then again, that's why I'm doing this retrospective, to help to explain to people that maybe didn't understand that. I usually get a lot of bouncing around. I get harped on or harassed and ordered without much thanks, if any. And this is quite true of the program. And then the topic shifts, because Wadsworth is remembering how he lost his wife, and he can understand not being given thanks, because as that portion of the Clue movie goes, Mr. Boddy was using Wadsworth and his wife as though they were slaves in order to keep silent about the socialism thing. Just having friends who were socialists, you know, that old witch hunt. So Wadsworth very likely wasn't treated very well, and his wife finally killed herself because she couldn't take it. And that kind of set Wadsworth free, but then he lost his wife, who he cared very deeply for. But of course, Willie is considering that with A Good Lady Is Nothing to Joke About, because he's also starting to understand that one of the ways that he's behaved in the past towards women was also quite wrong. But one of the reasons he did that is because he very likely was exposed to that kind of behavior working from other people. So this is a lot of Willie Loomis calming down. And yeah, I wonder if that gave anybody relief. I really do. It helped me, just because that was where I had to build up again while I was creating these shows, to go through this trouble with Willie and actually inhabit his persona going through that stuff. And I wanted to desperately get him calmed down. And I think one of the reasons I have also calmed down, other than having the support that I need, was also getting Willie Loomis calmed down. And he gets crazy again in 16, so we're not losing the crazy Willie that a lot of people love. He's just doing it for the greater good. And that also happened in the show, as far as I can recall. But then, of course, it wraps up very nicely with some fun. Because, yeah, I was wondering, when did these people get a chance to sleep? So Wadsworth suggests, maybe a good nap is in order. And Willie's, that's what it is. It does come back to people being nice, I'm going crazy. How could this be possible? You're like, I actually get to sleep? Wadsworth has to smile. Of course, Mr. Loomis, we all do these days. But of course, then, dogs are howling. Now, it's funny, because when dogs howl on the original Dark Shadows, Willie freaks out. And then there was another point at which he was worried about Barnabas becoming a vampire again. He's like, the dogs are going to start howling again. So I figured for episode 15 of The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, he's just like, oh, you see, I knew it couldn't last. The dogs are howling again. Then I thought, wow, wouldn't that be something, that he would have run away from Hill House, according to the history of The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, that Willie and Wadsworth knew each other back then, that there were all those dogs. Maybe part of why the dogs howling freaks Willie out is because of the dogs from Clue the movie, and a possibly younger him being scared of it, because they got pretty wild, those dogs. So because Wadsworth also understands that, don't go outside. I'm willing to purchase more trousers for you, but not an entire spring wardrobe. And then we go back to Clue the movie joke, because there was that moment where Wadsworth had stepped on some dog dew and everybody in the house is just sniffing. So in this instance, Wadsworth finally notices maybe there's this smell, and he asks, oh dear, when Willie was outside with Sarah, did you step in anything out there? So as strong as that is for really good stuff, we have a little humor at the end, and it coincides with both Dark Shadows and Clue the movie. I keep on looking forward to working with Willie and Wadsworth more.
What was it my auntie had said about seeing them in the novel? She saw, what a charming upstairs-downstairs pair. Now, what I believe is the 11th scene for episode 15 is, we have it, after Barnabas meeting another vampire cousin, now he gets to meet the ghost of Caleb Collins. Yeah, thankfully it wasn't as long as the one in 16, because Maggie and Caleb had a lot to talk about, whereas there's some pretty simple stuff with Caleb and Barnabas, and as you understand, if you've heard previous shows, that I did my best to base Caleb on what evidence I could get from the television show alone. And it's funny because within a number of months, I think, maybe just a year, Melissa and I were on the phone and she was all, you know, I finally saw the Dark Shadows portions where Caleb Collins is explained and mentioned. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, Daryl got it dead on. It was great to hear her say that. It was so wonderful. Because I really do try to do the best that I can do with what material is there and answering what-if questions in as likely as they could possibly turn out. So with this, it was nice to go through because it also ties in with Margaret Chazette Dupre. Caleb here is the one who calls her Margaret Dupre. He comes up with that because of how confusing her persona is. Which is very likely another reason why nobody was able to do this till many decades after the show aired. So, yeah, there's all the banging around, just the ghostly stuff. Now, I have a confession to make that I hope you enjoy. The echo in Caleb Collins' laughter actually came from me messing up. I was getting so into the role and just doing the laugh, and I hit the microphone. And I was like, oh, that laugh was so good, I don't want to lose it. But there's a microphone hit in the darn thing. What could I do to maybe cover it up and make it seem like he's just kind of rattling the house some more or something? And so I was like, well, let's put an echo in. And ever since then, there's a lot of laughter of Caleb Collins that's put into an echo form. Because it works so well, especially with the music. And you really feel like, okay, as silly as a lot of this is a Colin Wood spook. And even though he's doing his darndest to be scary, Caleb is asking Barnabas to stop being so perturbed. Like, look at your life. You became a vampire because of a witch. That's fantastic enough. Then you lost your woman to a cliff fall. And she keeps incarnating for your dingy company. And then somewhere in there you lost your sister, who's managed to come back to you for a while almost 200 years later anyway. And about 1,001 other things, because with the soap opera you got 1,001 other things anyway. You know, haven't you ever mellowed to all this garbage? And then I had the wonderful thing, because I've talked to Oisin about this too. Caleb says, still so Mr. Darcy, Barnabas Collins. Because that's from Pride and Prejudice, if you know that. The reason that I had brought it up with Oisin is that knowing Pride and Prejudice and knowing Mr. Darcy prior to watching Dark Shadows, it was very easy for me to see, oh, okay, Barnabas Collins, villain at first, and then Mr. Darcy, because he switches on you, just like Mr. Wickham does, and who I really feel that Nathan Forbes is also kind of based on. And Oisin said, yeah, pretty much. Villain at first, and then Mr. Darcy. I think that's another reason that the working title for Pride and Prejudice was First Impressions. First impressions can be incorrect when you are trying to assess a person. And I felt that Barnabas was very much like that. And Melissa and I have talked about, yeah, there seems to be quite a few things in the 1790s portion of Dark Shadows that feel very based on Pride and Prejudice, feel very based on the works of Jane Austen. And that never makes it to an official list anywhere, I don't think, but I would not mind seeing it. And we've wondered about that. So with Barnabas and Caleb in this scene, it comes to pass that Barnabas catching up on his reading, because Pride and Prejudice was a little after the time he got stuck in the box, he understands, oh, Pride and Prejudice, being called Mr. Darcy is probably a better mistake to make, you know, than that other Mr. Collins in the book, because the Mr. Collins that proposes to Elizabeth Bennet, everybody's like, And my husband and I watched the 1995 version of Pride and Prejudice recently. He was tripping on that guy. He was tripping on the mother, too, but he was tripping on Mr. Collins. He's like, she's like, oh my gosh. And when he was talking about the stairs in Pride and Prejudice, you know, not too low or too steep, I'm like, he's really into the details. And my husband was like, yeah, he is. So there is that little piece of pop culture reference that
the Collinses can have, because I figure one can't, in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, discuss other characters as though they watch television. But we can play around with, well, they're able to read books. But then Caleb notices the difference in their age, so he's like, you know, you probably shouldn't call me Uncle Caleb. You should probably call me Nephew Caleb. And that was something, I believe, in episode 13, when he's joking about Barnabas Collins to Elizabeth Stoddard. He says, "But that Barnabas, sheesh, I could even call him my uncle. What a twisted spectacle of problems he's got." Which would venture to display that Barnabas Collins is a wee bit older than even the ghost of Caleb Collins.
And it's funny, too, because very often I hear that people called Barnabas Uncle Barnabas in the show, but I don't remember that anywhere. I could be off, because most of the time I heard Cousin Barnabas. So it feels like, whether that's true or not, we do have somebody who can call him Uncle Barnabas, and that is the ghost of Caleb Collins. Now, one thing that Oisin did point out that might be slightly an error, although I have checked this and I feel that it's well-founded, that one of the things Caleb is tickled by was explaining to Barnabas, "You were having your verbose chess match over Victoria Winters with that Burke Devlin in my house." And I've gone over those episodes. It's been a long time, so they're a little vague in my memory, but I'm remembering going over those again because Oisin was pointing out, well, I don't know if I remember that. If it didn't take place, it could have taken place because they were just fighting over her so much. I mean, the reason it tickles Caleb is because Barnabas's interest in Victoria Winters is a Josette thing, and he's seeing Burke Devlin as Jeremiah Collins. And with his fragmented memory, because you had to write it that way for the soap opera because you're making it up as you go, it is the only time that I can recall that Barnabas got pursuant against another man. And it would make sense, being Burke Devlin, who had possibly once been Jeremiah, it reminds him of Jeremiah. This is one of those people who got in my way of true happiness, so he's doing that, whereas in other instances, he's not as possessive. So it kind of goes back to the psychology of Barnabas Collins' history, his younger days. Why would he have these associations with Victoria Winters and Burke Devlin? But yes, that's the reason that Caleb is tickled, because he sees that too. And then points out, because a lot of people go with this, and that's why there's that great Joan Bennett clip where she says to the audience, "I'm talking to you as Elizabeth Stoddard, and yes, Victoria Winters was my daughter," because there was another thing that they were playing with. So I just was like, go for it. And I've been told, yeah, go for it. But Oisin gets a little like, she's done other historical research where maybe they weren't going to go in that direction and that maybe she didn't want to either. So it was one of those things where I was like, well, I hope this is okay because this is what I planned from the beginning because it was what they were going with. So Caleb just says straight up, "You do realize she's Elizabeth's daughter, right?" And then those spooky music like, "What?" And then he makes the joke, "You really dodged a silver bullet with that one," that Wadsworth had helped him with that. So then they get back to Barnabas asking Caleb, "Why are you so concerned over this Tom Jennings?" And Caleb is just also saying flat out, "He's one of ours," meaning he's a member of the family. "And someone's got to look out for him. It might as well be me." And just going crazy. All the nonsense in this town, just from your one little nightstand or whatever, because there's always these ideas that maybe it wasn't just one night in Martinique with Angelique. Maybe it was nights. Maybe it was two. I don't know. So just going over that, because a lot of people see, including Caleb, that was when a lot of the trouble began, was this infidelity issue, but that they're going to have to start working together. And Caleb is warning Barnabas, you know, you can't stick around the summer of love much longer, but that if Barnabas is as good as he's gotten and he keeps on going, the happiness will be waiting for him. And he says, "And my connections swear there will be none of that parallel time nonsense." And then he has to explain what parallel time is to Barnabas, because it's just like, oh man, the quantum physics, blah, 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 blah. Just ask the smart girls around here. There are plenty of them. But he's warning that the 1897 trip is going to show up eventually for Barnabas. And if he proves his worth in that, she'll still be waiting for you, that Margaret Dupre. And Barnabas gets confused again. Margaret Dupre? And then we just scramble around all the different names, or Kitty Evans, or Josette Soames. And then from the mixture of the extra incarnation who is a man that I made up, or Lady Hansel Hampshire, whatever. And I was reading that to my husband, and he paused and said, "Lady
Hansel Hampshire. And I remember Lisa, she had something to say about that I just loved. She said, laugh out loud, Margaret Dupre, Kitty Evans, or Josette Soames. Yeah, you need a playbill to keep this stuff straight. And she liked where Caleb says, of Maggie, she's already changed you. And that's no small accomplishment. Can't argue with that. Oh, and also pointing out, and Silent Spirits, a warning of Quentin and Beth, perhaps. Yeah, because Lisa knows her onions. And that is what that is. But yeah, one of my favorite lines for Caleb, that whatever her name is, all I know and you know is that it's her. And that's the one smart decision you've ever been determined about. I know there's something deeper in that desire of yours. And I welcome it! And he's into that just because, yeah, it is the girl of his dreams. She keeps on coming back. He really wants Barnabas to stop complaining. And he knows that this marriage is the answer. He welcomes it. It's going to be a change for the better. And because so many people have considered Josette or any pretty girl is just bubble-headed and that kind of stuff, I mean, Barnabas, he says, from your demeanor, I expected you to be like the rest in believing I did want an object of no complexity. Because, yeah, she underdeveloped. Really? I think she's so overdeveloped you didn't notice how developed she was, which is so extreme. Not simple. This is the one character that I have the hardest time with because of the complexity. And that's me saying it. And Caleb, he confesses, I've had to watch this town in total disgust while they all ate each other alive and then regurgitated it so they could repeat their grotesque performance. And that Maggie being a combination. Talking about how, like Tom, you know, Tom's pretty attractive himself, but Maggie, like Tom, not just a pretty face. And it's sad how beauty attracts on the outside so much when there is so much more to it. That's a combination is what all this is about. You have more than one facet that is attractive to people. Yeah, with Maggie, a combination is dead right, and she will change this place. And then talks about the silent ghosts. Now, if you see some ghosts in the main house, don't shake in your shoes, though they will be more silent than I, because Caleb is obviously a talker, whereas Quentin and Beth are silent. And I say this is going to get on Captain Greg's nerves if he encounters them. Like, why don't you speak? You know, why are you so quiet? Captain Grave doesn't give a darn about the mystique issue of the ghosts. He's used to ghosts who can speak for themselves. And also, yeah, it was really difficult for me when I put this together because somebody had passed away. I found out about that, so I felt a little, I mean, I had to let Tom go because we can't have two Don Briscoes running around. Exactly. But I kind of felt that, yeah, letting him go, I was shaken, and I think it had something to do with hearing about another death that happened at the same time. So I was able to release some of the sorrow with having to let Tom go and being very sad about it. But Tom was avenged in episode 11 in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows. But also, it's a good, because it also wipes out, you know, the excess of Tom having become a vampire if he's just wiped out immediately. That Angelique just drains him dry. So when Tom meets Angelique on the docks, she's trying to understand why she feels weak due to decisions she's made in the past. So again, slowly trying to work her into knowing what good is and how to achieve it slowly. So Tom is thinking, yeah, this person needs some company and maybe we could have a drink. And the joke comes back, oh, I love a drink from you. So even with the humor, it's still quite sad because she gets a little momentum into thinking over the mistakes in her life and, oh, it's possible maybe this good thing is a better idea than all this other stuff I've been doing to achieve my gains. And then the urge for blood as a vampire snaps her back into the villainous role. So that is about it for episode 15. Glad to be doing this just to have something positive to put together. And yeah, I mean, it got everybody in there. Just about everybody. It really was something else. This episode 15 of Blundering Succubus. Kids in the Hall, Adam's Family, The Munsters, Clue, and Dark Shadows, of course. 1960s television show. Now to get to something I felt was very important for the end of episode 15. Bless This House.
I had not been familiar with the lyrics of the Poltergeist theme until much later. And as I went through it, I realized this is very effectual for multiple reasons. Even though bad things are happening, Angelique is about to kill Tom Jennings, this is a very dysfunctional family that we want to work out, just as the human race is a very dysfunctional family that we all want to work out, most of us anyway. So as I looked at the lyrics, "Bless this house and the souls within, through the night till it's light again, light our hearts to the dark, to the breaking day, sailing together one family. Save me from bad dreams if they should come. Keep us together one family. Nothing can tear apart." So it's very much like the Collins and everything that touches them, one family, and a dysfunctional family at that, but also the human race, you know, and here we are on the internet trying to make that darn thing work. And what is impeding us, of course, that I discovered later was the commercialism, the Morlock eating the Eloy, the us eating each other, the whole vampirism thing, which we ought to be more reluctant about and more aware of. And of course, that's why George in the Time Machine was so angry at the Eloy for being so naive and had to reflect that they'd been brought up that way. So he couldn't be angry at them. And he was down on himself for being angry. And Weena just had to shrug because she didn't even understand. But with this, yeah. And that makes it even more powerful, the Bless This House song. And hopefully people listening will understand that. But it's for the story of Poltergeist. But it's also for all of us. And the thing about this, you know, for Heather, Poltergeist I saw at home. That's my memory of it. Poltergeist 2 we saw in the theater. Poltergeist 3, we were loyal to the franchise of the films, which was one of the reasons they made that film. And we sat there, and we noticed in the credits that it was dedicated to the memory of Heather O'Rourke. And ever since then, I have very strongly felt it's the least they can do, but that's not good enough. And so, in the creation of A Blundering Succubus, this is good enough, and hopefully there are other things that are good enough for the memory of Heather O'Rourke. And I would love for you to get in touch with me by email or on the weblog about any memories that you want to share in what you have appreciated of Heather O'Rourke's life and work. And it doesn't have to have anything to do with my work or with this episode of The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows. You could just say, "I'm only here to talk about Heather," or parentheses, "Heather O'Rourke," whatever you want to do, because I have tried to look for information online and I get a lot of gossip and it bugs me. So I am more than happy to listen to what anyone has to say within reason of why they love Heather O'Rourke's work, what they want to share about what they know of her life, because I don't want to Google search this crap anymore. I'm fed up with looking for my memories of her, looking for factual information of her, and just seeing a whole lot of gossip. You know, I would really prefer just people who knew her to get in touch and just say, "This is what I want to say." It'd be great to have the weblog for this podcast be just about her. I'd be happy with that. It was one of the reasons I was upset when I shared the script and nobody was saying anything just for her. You know, it bothered me that you couldn't at least, that I dedicated this episode to her, that nobody could even say something about her. Really, really bothered me. So there we are for that. So I'd like to wrap this up with what I feel is very good advice. As you know, I have found some of the nurturing that was required to continue the audio drama and more upbeat podcasts. That doesn't come from sharing files on social media. That doesn't come from stalking. That doesn't come from rude behavior. It comes from nurturing behavior. People writing letters to me with a sense of decorum, self-respect, good manners, and ability in being honest with themselves. That's how things have gotten better for me and for this show. I know that there is still the weird idea that using the like button and share button to excess is going to help to encourage others to speak, and it doesn't.
I have one new person interested who thought it would help automatically, and I said, I've been putting this together for over 5 years, and I appreciate the effort, but it has never helped to get people talking. Never. Just keep telling me what you're enjoying. That's what's going to help. It is just so sad for me to witness how horribly degraded our nurturing skills have gotten, as well as our ability to make friends. Whereas, after a number of poor examples, I found the better people through those who still knew how to correspond and were interested, or they wanted to keep writing to me even if they weren't interested. I've halted some correspondence, sadly, because one or another pen pal was greedily going online and being rude to me. Well, would you want to keep in contact with someone who'd been rude to you? Well, I hope you wouldn't want that. However, when I thank the pen friends I've made in these podcasts, I'm sure you know who you are, since I'm still writing to you and thanking you for being there. Obviously, I can't be thanking anyone who is being shifty or greedy. Why would I? But in this journey, I have discovered what I felt was the better course in the long run, which was pen pals who could do the long-term dialogue and show more care and thoughtfulness in both their life choices and their discussion skills. And that rather brings me back to Willie Loomis being offered penmanship to practice prior to our discovering this solution in real life. It's a good lesson. So I just want to encourage you, the person listening, not the magical other listeners that you're imagining I'm talking to instead, for you, yourself, to learn how to correspond. Particularly if you really enjoy this, just go back to good manners. Social media didn't help us to learn that, so I will give you 3 different people to look into instead. Miss Manners, Emily Post, and Amy Vanderbilt. None of them is or were perfect, but the point was to make the effort. So, no worries about social media use. It's obviously removed what good manners we had. Go with Miss Manners, Emily Post, and Amy Vanderbilt. There are also a lot of books out there about how to write letters. In fact, I've just looked at Gutenberg.org and wrote the words letter write, finding a slew of selections about letter writing. And I know there are videos as well as other freebies available online to teach or perhaps reteach you how to construct a letter. A nice one. One that expresses your interests and details. And that very long unused ability of being constructive. So don't worry about criticism, really. That is for the companies who make the money by using cheap ploys to grab your attention. I wrote to a pen friend that the irony of critiquing is that it's meant to keep moneymakers from getting you with cheap thrills instead of a good story. Now people criticize in order to get cheap thrills of their own. And before sending it, I read it to my sweetheart, and he laughed. Because yes, being a harsh critic has gotten very, very trendy, to the point it became hate speak and rudeness. I don't know about all y'all, but that doesn't interest me. But it got so trendy and prevalent that it just taught us to harass each other. It's like a dog angrily barking to get attention. That's hardly human, is it? But I have seen someone with LibriVox doing a good job when they find mean reviews, because they're pointing out that the harsh reviews don't make sense. And they don't. The harsh critics reviewing LibriVox books seem to have no clue that it's about volunteer work. They review things like, who hired this person? And the ironic thing is, no one hired them. They are volunteering to do something that is fulfilling for them and might help others to have a story read to them. It's not to make any money of any kind, even though shifty companies have used them to make money. But criticizing people doing things for free? Well, look no further than Daryl War, right? I'm not making money. I just want friendship and discussion. But we all got super, super mixed up with the difference. Sure, I'm making money for others. We saw that years ago with the Vedera song. But all I'm gaining is potential friendships, which is what a lot of us want. Suddenly, and quickly, big companies tricked us into believing business maneuvers and competition was going to improve our social skills, and it does nothing of the kind. It makes the friendship suffer, or even die. It also makes volunteers quit. Volunteers go out of their way to be helpful to others. And if all they get in return is people being greedy and rude, then, yeah, they quit. There's nothing to be gained at all if they're basically being punished by being nice to someone. Forget it. So, just hold that thought when you finish this program here. Look into letter writing. All you need is a search engine. I highly recommend Gutenberg.org. There are also the good manners instructions out there. And then take the S out of stalking. Talking. That's what I would like for you to try. And you just might discover the same reaction Willie Loomis had in episode 15. All he really needed was good teachers with factual instruction and casual kindness. Take care.